My name's Richard Dennis, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute, and you're listening to The Lucky Country, a weekly podcast brought to you by Schwartz Media, the publisher of The Monthly and The Saturday Paper, and Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. The Saturday Paper is my source of quality long-form journalism every weekend, and The Monthly is this country's best magazine of politics, culture and ideas. I even publish some of mine from time to time. This episode I'll be talking to Professor George Williams from the University of New South Wales about what rights we do and don't have in Australia, Simon Shaikh, former National Director of GetUp and co-founder of Future Super, and I'll be joined by Chris Fry for our Sensible Centre segment where we talk about the budget and whether we are really living beyond our means or not. 20 years ago, when I was travelling in Eastern Europe, I was detained in a newsagent. I don't mean because someone couldn't find their purse. I mean the doors got locked and I wasn't allowed to leave for about an hour. It was nothing personal. There'd been a blackout and as a result, the security screen at the front of the store, the one used to prevent shoplifting, wasn't working. So the store owner assumed we were all thieves and locked us in. That trivial event had a big impact on my life. It made me think hard for the first time about rights, responsibilities and the burden of proof. It made me realise the enormous role that culture plays in shaping what we think is fair and right and just. I'd never been locked in a news agency in Australia. In Australia, we don't usually assume people are guilty until they're proven innocent. Well, maybe we don't assume powerful people are guilty until they're proven innocent. Powerful people deserve the presumption of innocence in Australia. And in turn, it's obvious that we should give Michaelia Cash the benefit of the doubt. And of course, it would be unreasonable to expect Barnaby Joyce to repay the salary the High Court says he wasn't entitled to draw. He was doing his best. But earlier this year, tens of thousands of Australians received letters from Barnaby and Michaelia's government demanding that they either produce pay sheets from a decade ago or repay what the government recently decided might have been an overpayment. After the High Court ruled that six sitting MPs were not eligible to sit in Parliament because they had dual citizenship, the Attorney-General, George Brandis, bemoaned the brutal literalism with which the High Court had interpreted the Constitution. But of course, George Brandis's own government has relied heavily on brutal literalism to chase welfare recipients for small sums of money, to keep asylum seekers locked up, and to expel residents of Australia who've lived here nearly their whole life after they breached a minor law. Australian politicians like to talk about the alleged unique Australian value of mateship and sticking together and fairness. But of course, many of those same politicians are quick to turn on vulnerable sections of the community the minute they think it will win them popular support amongst other groups of voters. But luckily, we live in a country of laws where those in power are subject to checks and balances and accountability. Luckily, we have a constitution that defends our rights. Or do we?
Well, given that Tony Abbott and George Brandis have both made it clear that they believe freedom of speech, freedom of expression are big issues and the Human Rights Commission should be dealing with these issues, do you think that they might look at bringing in legislation like a Human Rights Act or referred to as a Bill of Rights in other countries that would enshrine values of freedom of expression into our law?
At the Human Rights Commission, we've been asking for this for a very long time. We believe that we do need some legislative provisions that state these core freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom not to be detained arbitrarily, for example. These are core freedoms dating back to the Magna Carta in 1215.
I'm now joined by Professor George Williams, Dean of the Law School at the University of New South Wales. George has recently written a book called A Charter of Rights for Australia. George, I've watched a lot of American television. I know Americans have got the right to free speech and the right to own a machine gun. What rights do we have in Australia?
Well, the short answer is most people assume we've got those same rights the Americans have. I think we watch too much US cop shows and the like, because in fact it's very common in Australian courts that people assert even the right to bear arms, but certainly the right to freedom of speech and all sorts of things. And it's not just the community. In fact, I was once speaking to someone who worked at the New South Wales Parliamentary Library who said one of the most common questions for new parliamentarians from them was, where do I get a copy of the Bill of Rights? So So Australians think we have lots of rights, that we in fact have the US Bill of Rights, but the reality is very different. We're the only democracy in the world that does not have a national Bill of Rights or Charter of Rights or the like, and it means that there are gaping holes in the sort of protection that we have. Even things like freedom of speech are very ill-protected in Australia, and many of the most basic things that people assume you have in a democracy, well, we have them, but only if our politicians don't take them away.
The only democracy in the world that doesn't have a bill or a charter of rights.
Yeah, look, it's quite remarkable, isn't it? And it's a bold claim to make, but in writing my book, A Charter of Rights for Australia, I actually went through and had a student go through all the democracies to check them out, and that is the answer. It's just now a stock standard part of what it means to be a democracy. And as an Australian, if you travel and talk about constitutional law in those other countries, they're quite stunned on occasion to say, well, how do you have a democracy without citizens' free speech being protected or the right to vote being preserved? Because today it's seen as just one of those things like a parliament or the court system that you need to have to make sure that the people who exercise power do so in a way that's respectful of the citizens and their place within that democracy. We've got one of the oldest constitutions in the world, and our system of government speaks to a different era, an entirely different set of values, and unlike other countries, we haven't gone through a modernisation process.
What you're suggesting is that there's nothing to stop us implementing a Charter of Rights or a Bill of Rights if we wanted to. We just haven't got around to it yet.
Well, pretty much. And it's not actually from want of trying. Every Labor government post-World War II has sought to do this in one way or the other. So we had a referendum in the late 40s in the Chifley era. Gough Whitlam attempted a Human Rights Act in the 70s, Bob Hawke in the 80s. Kevin Rudd ran a massive human rights consultation with over 40,000 people involved that reported in 2010. But it's really been a series of problems with political management, if nothing else. Countries like the UK, good comparators, 1998, they got the Human Rights Act, New Zealand in 1990, Canada in 1982. There's no fundamental reason we're different, except we have mucked up the politics of this and not been able to properly reflect strong community desire for the change. Because what the polling shows, and it has for some decades now, is between about 60 to 80% of Australians think we should have a National Bill of Rights. Many think we've already got it, of course. And when they hear we don't, well, they say we should. We want our interests properly protected against politicians. It's the politicians who've let us down in getting this done.
Well, it's interesting because conservatives are often talking about the rights of the individual, the importance of individuals in society, yet you've just given us a history in which it's the Labor Party that keeps pushing for a Charter of Rights. Presumably the conservatives keep resisting it.
They do, and indeed in 2010 the Conservatives did, on the somewhat perplexing topic that we need to protect religious rights, so let's not have a Bill of Rights, despite the fact that religious rights will be one of the first things you include. And in fact, we're talking about same-sex marriage at the moment. It'd be very helpful to have a clear statement of religious protection in the Constitution, so we know that when we hopefully get same-sex marriage, things are properly balanced out and religious rights are properly protected. It's a pretty straightforward thing to do, but quite difficult when you don't have the underlying protection. What the typical pattern is, it is often seen as a progressive change. So Labor in New Zealand and the UK bringing this change in, for example. But then it tends to be embraced by the Conservatives who realise the framework can work for them. And many of these rights, speech and the like, actually play quite strongly to their agendas. So there's never been an instance when one of these instruments has been brought in and has ever been removed. They tend to be quite popular and effective. They stick once they're there.
Look, over the course of this series, we've spoken to a number of people about things as diverse as the National Disability Insurance Scheme or access to mental health care or indeed rape and domestic violence counselling services. What's in it for citizens to have a charter or a Bill of Rights? How might a charter or a Bill of Rights help a welfare recipient who's having trouble with the state or a community organisation that can't get the funding it needs to provide what people think of as basic services?
Well, and that's really the test, isn't it? Because there's no point having a law that sits there looking pretty and not actually changing things. And The reason these things are kept is because they change lives. They tend to be very effective in giving people power to address what are unfair or wrong government policies. And it's often not maliciousness on the part of government. It's just arbitrary, it's bureaucracy gone wrong. And they put power in the hands of citizens to get things rectified. Victoria has got its own Charter of Rights, as does the ACT. And there are many, many examples where no litigation required. Actually, court cases are quite rare. But when government is faced that it's misusing its power, it makes changes. And so to give you some examples in Victoria, particularly when it comes to kids with disabilities, there's been significant changes. Earlier policies meant that some kids with forms of autism got no special needs assistance in school. There's no good medical reason for it. It just was the way the policy was. The charter was used to drive a change and to make sure kids who needed help got it. And you can imagine, there's not much more fundamental as a child in school than getting what you need to get a good education. It's also had a big impact in public housing, where policies meant that people with a criminal record could be denied public housing. We had people, women, particularly single mothers with kids, facing eviction literally on the streets, and the interests of the kids were not taken into account. Again, it led to a change. There's actually a book put out a little while ago with 101 case studies just from Victoria alone showing where people's lives have been improved. And what it shows is it's about prevention, changing government practice. Let's keep this out of the court as much as we can, but let's get government making better decisions, particularly in delivering services to what are often disadvantaged people.
Wow, helping individuals navigate the oppressive power of the state. You can see why free marketeers hate the idea.
Well, you can also see why it tends to be popular amongst people, because there are a legion of examples of arbitrary bureaucracy, just unthinking, not taking into account people's interests as they should, and this resets the balance.
Finally, George, there was an important High Court case recently in which Bob...
Not only one?
Actually, you've skewered me so well, I'm going to ask that whole thing again. George, there's been a number of important High Court cases in recent weeks, one of which revolved around Bob Brown going to the High Court seeking effectively the right to political expression. Obviously, we don't have a Charter of Rights, but the High Court found in his favour in that instance. So isn't that some form of evidence that we don't need a Charter of Rights, that we've got the High Court?
Well, it's good evidence that we do have some rights, and sometimes they can make a difference. And that's right. What we've got is sort of an ad hoc, scattered set of protection that every now and then is effective, but more often than not actually doesn't get you very far. But the Bob Brown case is a really good example of both the potential. Yes, he won the case. The Tasmanian anti-protest laws were struck down, but also the weaknesses, because what the court said is that the free speech rights are so weak that, yes, you can actually criminalise, you can stop protest, but they said in this occasion the Tasmanian law was just so badly drafted that it couldn't stand. And it's now open to Tasmania to redraft its law and criminalise Bob Brown's conduct again, should it so wish. So it's really almost a Pyrrhic victory, I think. And the question is, do parliaments now want to take advantage of this limited form of rights protection to reintroduce it?
And just sticking with that idea of political expression, obviously at the moment the federal government seems very concerned that lots of individuals in the community support an organisation called Get Up, and that they're out there knocking on doors and talking to people about things they care about. Would a Charter of Rights potentially reflect the ability for communities to organise around the things they want and participate in the democracy however they want?
Yes, it could certainly make a difference there. And one of the big weaknesses at the national level at the moment is we don't have any clear and strong right to association. That's a problem for unions, political organisations generally, certainly organisations like GetUp. And it means that bodies like GetUp can exist within our electoral system so long as a law is not passed to cruel their activities. And indeed, if Parliament wished to pass a law, there are a number of types of laws it could enact that would make it very hard for GetUp or other organisations to have anything like the effect they do. You know, GetUp's got to play the political game. It's got to hope the numbers are there to stop that. But if they are there, there's no backstop that protects their interests.
Well, it might be surprising in Australia for many people that we don't have as many rights as people think we do, but it's good to know that there are opportunities out there for us to fix that if we want to get around to it. George Williams, thanks for coming onto The Lucky Country.
Thanks, Richard.
That was Professor George Williams from the University of New South Wales and the author of A Charter of Rights for Australia.
A number of factors went against the coalition. First of all, we had GetUp besmirching the character of a great Australian servant, Andrew Nicholson.
The stench that is GetUp, an organisation that runs grossly dishonest, deceptive and manipulative campaigns to support the ugly extreme left of Australian politics.
I'm now joined by Simon Shaikh. Simon's a former national director of GetUp and the co-founder of Future Super. Simon, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country.
Nice to be with you.
Simon, you've been a bit in the news lately talking about the government's attacks on GetUp. Why do you think the government's so interested in what GetUp's doing at the moment?
Well, it seems this government has realised that organised civil society is a threat to them, just as it is to any government that's holding back progressive change. So rather than trying to build their own grassroots mobilisation capacity, which they've tried and failed at before, rather than trying that again, they're clearly trying to attack civil society, whether it be what they're trying to do using the parliament to try and block donations being tax deductible, whether it be trying to force the AEC or pressure the AEC into labelling GetUp an associated entity, or just outright attacking the credibility of progressive organisations like GetUp. This is a smear campaign from the government because they feel they have no other choice.
Look, I know it's your former role, but how does it feel when you hear that an organisation you once led is simultaneously an associated entity of the Labor Party and the Greens, given that the Labor Party and Greens are rather combative towards each other, especially around election time? How would one associate themselves with two such rivalrous entities?
Well, you and I think are in a fairly unique position to know about this because, as you know, Richard, and perhaps we can recount some stories, you and I have both had heated conversations with the Greens, with the Labor Party, with each other. I mean, the reality of politics is that you find yourselves on different sides of issues despite having similar values from time to time. So in the case of GetUp, I mean, very heated debates and discussions with the Greens, the same with the Labor Party. It was even the case, for example, at one point that we drew up plans at GetUp to see whether we could encourage people to vote against Martin Ferguson, one of the people who was holding back change inside the Labor Party. I mean, I don't know whether you yourself can think of any examples where you've had that type of interaction.
I'm not sure this is how the show's supposed to go, but since you brought it up, yeah, look, obviously, you know, in my time at the Australia Institute, I was highly critical, for example, of the Greens' opposition to reintroducing the indexation of fuel excise. You know, basically the coalition was proposing to increase the tax on petrol. I thought that was a great idea. It was long-standing policy to fix that of the Greens, and indeed something I'd talked about for a long period of time, yet at some point the Greens were opposed to that, and I had a rather public debate with the Greens about that at the time, which surprised many people, but it didn't really surprise the people at the Australia Institute or the people closest to the Australia Institute, because I was simply sticking to a policy position that we'd always held. So, yeah, I understand your plight when people are determined to put you in a pigeonhole, but I guess that's the reality of modern politics. Everyone wants to put everyone else in a box.
That's right, and I think one of the things that's missed a lot in public debate is an understanding of the role of different organisations. So the Greens' theory of change, for example, is that they need to build their electoral representatives in order to have power in the parliament. That's a perfectly acceptable theory of change, and what it means is that on occasion you've got to put politics above policy. Now, they're never going to do that in a way that is over the top, but that's the reality of a political party. It's got to get people elected. An issues-based organisation has so many more freedoms to just be completely pure and focused on the most appropriate positions of the day. And a think tank, I would say even further, because a think tank usually doesn't get involved in the intricacies of implementation of that policy or the politics around that policy. Now, obviously, what makes you and the Australia Institute more interesting than any other think tank in Australia is that your ideas tend to be closer to what is politically realistic and implementable, but also progressive, but also connected to the current political debate. So I suppose that's why you and I have had so much fun over the years in these organisations that we previously ran.
Thank you for the kind words. But look, you're right. And it's interesting because often when I speak, people say, oh, Richard, that's great. You know, why don't you run for Parliament? And my answer is, well, because everything I just told you is exactly what I think, and I'm in the privileged position of being able to tell you exactly what I think, and I don't have to go and say it on behalf of an entire electorate, let alone a political party. So it's easy for me to speak frankly and openly and honestly because I'm actually speaking purely for myself. But at the same time, that's why I feel obliged to cut politicians a lot of slack. It's their job to compromise, etc. So no, you're right. For organisations like GetUp or the Australia Institute, there is a privilege that being able to put ideas out there and build support for them. But at the same time, it must come as maybe not a shock, but it must concern you to see a government so determined to say that a civil society organisation working with its members to influence public debate is doing anything other than strengthening our democracy.
Yeah, I think in the case of GetUp, anything the government does strengthens the organisation. It's just got so much momentum now.
Do you think they know that, by the way? I can't get my head around the strategy.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I remember when I think it was Senator Ian MacDonald got up in the Parliament and suggested that GetUp was an arm of the Hitler Youth. we sent out an email and $180,000 came in the next few hours. So I rang then-Senator, now Vic Nick Xenophon, and I said, Nick, would you mind going up to Senator MacDonald and telling him that we're really grateful for the $180,000 he helped us raise today? And Senator Xenophon did that and told me that the look on Senator MacDonald's face was of dread and deep despair. So on occasion they've known that. I've made sure that they've known that. And it was written up in the Sunday papers recently and on Insiders, making the point that actually these sort of attacks make GetUp stronger. Now that's fine, but actually it's not all good, because there are other organisations who suffer or have the potential to suffer in the wake of all of this. So, for example, the federal government seems to think that GetUp takes foreign donations. I think it's about 0.5% of the total amount raised in the last 12 months from what I've read. So it's not really a thing. But there's a lot of charities that do. And so stopping charities being able to take those foreign donations, adding absurd conditions to how they can take those foreign donations, now that's actually worrying, because most not-for-profits in this country can't politically fight back in the way that a progressive social movement like GetUp can. So there are real problems that can occur, but they're certainly not going to occur for GetUp, and isn't that the great irony of the whole thing?
Well, I think there's a number of ironies, including that everyone from Corey Bernardi to the Liberal Party keeps threatening to set up their own GetUp while at the same time they rage against the effectiveness.
Yeah, that's right. Extraordinary.
Look, just changing the topic, you've obviously moved on from GetUp, and amongst other things, you set up Future Super, Australia's first fossil fuel free super fund. A tongue twister that I say every episode of The Lucky Country.
Thank you.
Thank you. But, you know, I guess that's an entirely different way to try and change the world. Obviously, getting involved in democracy is one way to do it, but marshalling people's investment funds and aiming them into the kinds of things that people want to see more of in the world, and steering them away from the things like new coal mines that a lot of us want to see less of, it's quite a different approach. How have you found that transition? How did you jump from GetUp to Superannuation Fund?
Well, when I was at GetUp, one of the key insights I had was that as progressive campaigners, we don't use every lever that we have, and in particular, really weak at using corporate levers. There are a couple of people out there, like the International Coalition Against Nuclear Armaments and a few other NGOs, that have done a decent job. And particularly emerging over the last few years, people involved in corporate disclosure and in putting resolutions to boards. But by and large, this is a huge gap in the progressive armoury. So when it came to the issue of climate change and investment in renewable energy, I was left thinking, well, with Tony Abbott getting elected, what are our options? Now, Australia has $2.1 trillion and growing every day in superannuation savings. Just a percentage, I would say less than 10% on our own modelling, spent between now and 2050 can move this country to 100% renewable energy. So challenging superannuation funds, I think, is actually an activist tactic wrapped up in a business, if you like, because it's all about trying to say to the industry, there's consumer demand and you better meet it. I mean, it's a classic switching campaign. The idea of Future Super is that we'd love to do ourselves out of a job by convincing every other super fund to go fossil fuel free and instead invest in climate solutions. So it's not that dissimilar to running GetUp at first glimpse. Of course, in reality, there's a lot of regulatory and investment sophistication behind the scenes. But the pure theory of change, I think, is one that you could understand quite easily.
Well, all I can say is I hope the government doesn't see your success at Future Super as a reason to attack you, or that if they do try to shut down Future Super, that their attempts to do so only help it grow. Thank you, Simon Shake, for coming onto The Lucky Country.
Nice to speak with you. Cheers.
That was Simon Shake, former National Director of GetUp and co-founder of Future Super. I'm now joined by Chris Fry for our Sensible Centre segment. Chris is usually seen as being a little bit to the right of me, but, you know, we like his opinion nonetheless. Chris, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country.
Thanks for having us here.
Chris, most people aren't thinking about next May's budget yet, but of course here in Canberra, that's what it's all about at this time of year. Are we living beyond our means?
I think governments have a capacity to live beyond their means for a long time, as you know, because they have the power to tax and they also control the currency. I think we are, and we need to do something about it. And unfortunately, the media psyche at the moment is it's much more fun to stop people fixing these problems than it is to sort of everyone get on board and fix them.
Well, that's because we're all looking after the little guy these days, aren't we? I mean, that's a good thing. Finally, we've got a Senate that'll say, no, why should we cut welfare for poor people when, you know, companies are demanding a tax cut?
Well, I agree with you on the company tax cut thing. It is preposterous for the government to be arguing to cut the tax now for only companies earning, I think it's over 50 million turnover a year and rising, at the same time as properly, I think, trying to restrain the growth in welfare spending and other areas.
Because the welfare recipients have had it too good for too long.
Well, obviously, you know, I wouldn't disagree with you about that, but but it is a serious problem. It's not an out of control problem. But in my view, to get the budget back into balance, we need to both improve the revenue effort and to cut spending. What's been happening is every time, and I take my hat off to the left for this, every time the government says, well, we want to cut some spending or indeed just reduce the rate that it increases, the immediate comeback is yes, but in fact, what we need to do is increase revenue as well. And I agree with that. I think that's correct. Of course, when it comes to cutting expenditure, the left aren't really there.
Well, that's not true. I mean, personally, I'd love to see some cuts to subsidies for the mining industry. I'd love to see a lot more scrutiny over a bunch of defence spending. I mean, I actually think the left are quite keen to cut spending on a whole bunch of areas.
Well, sure, to sacrifice our national security, I agree with you.
And ruin the economy.
No, not necessarily. But so in terms of corporate welfare, I'm totally with you. And unfortunately, we haven't really had a serious assault on that actually since the Hawke and Keating days. That was the really great thing that they did, driven by those two, but also Peter Walsh and a few other people who really understood that's a good way to go. Unfortunately, now the ethos on both sides there is really, you know, industry policy needs ongoing subsidies. And I think that's sad. But equally, to argue that the welfare state is not unsustainably growing, just like public health expenditure, it's just not true. It needs to be dealt with. And there are fair and smart options to do it. It's a pity that in the current political climate, it's very difficult for people of goodwill on both sides to sit down and make an arrangement about it.
So you're suggesting that you need the major parties to do bipartisan support for these big kind of spending cuts?
Yeah, that's right. And look, they're not big spending cuts. The simple truth is...
They are, Chris. They're big spending cuts. I can see the headline right now.
Yeah, well, exactly. And therein lies the problem. So I think it's up to you and I to develop a bipartisan position on this and take it up to the parliament. But no, but seriously, it's very easy to get into a debt trap. And the Commonwealth's not there yet, but we've gone from an incredibly strong fiscal position, which I think actually helps us bat way above our weight in other international fora as well. It's a bit, like a bit of a miracle economy stuff. And these guys have got a very civilised society, but they're not drowning in debt because of an overly generous welfare system like Western Europe is. And obviously we don't want to turn into America. That's a disaster. And it's also economically inefficient as well, in my view, being way too harsh on people and way too generous on the mega rich. There is a sensible centre, but at the moment, obviously the political forces are just too good to oppose anything and essentially beat it up and claim that any restraint of any expense is going to harm people. Just take one example. The notion that specialists, medical specialists, can't have their incomes cut a bit is ridiculous.
Well, I agree entirely.
Well, that's the point. Now, that would count as a cut to Medicare or something, and that's just ridiculous and it's unfair. Ophthalmologists is a classic example. There is tens or hundreds of millions of dollars a year there essentially being stolen from the public. The technology to do cataract replacements or improvements, it's allowed about, a 1,000% increase in productivity, and they've snaffled it all. There's a whole lot of areas like that, I think, in medicines as well, in drugs and whatever, where more should be done. And that's not going to hurt outcomes in the slightest.
So you're saying, and I suspect we agree on this, that when we talk about spending cuts now, the focus is always on what's the impact on the most vulnerable people, when the easiest and arguably most efficient place to make the cuts is not the quality of service being delivered to those at the bottom, but the cost of providing the service by those often earning huge amounts of money.
Absolutely. I could give a plug to the Greens here. The same sort of logic.
This is a rare day.
It is. I know. I'll have to deny it. But they essentially took that position a couple of years ago when there was a proposition to essentially reverse the outrageous expansion of the age pension that Howard had done in his final year, in his desperate year, which put billions and billions onto the forward estimates for literally the richest retirees in the country. And a deal was struck, which the Greens supported, the ALP did not support it, which was to boost the maximum rate of pension in order to allow a tightening of the criteria around which part pensioners get paid. That actually commenced on the 1st of July. The world didn't end. The coffee shops of Toorak and Mossman are still in existence, I think. There'll be a slightly lower pool of inheritance down the track. But, I mean, that's a good example of, and there's billions of dollars saved in that, and it's perfectly reasonable.
Well, there you go. Chris Fry backing in the Greens' fiscal conservatism. I think we've found our way to the sensible theatre yet again.
Maybe not there again, but yes.
Thanks for coming on, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
That brings us to the end of this week's episode. The Lucky Country is a Schwartz Media production, brought to you by Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. The show's produced by Andy Hazel, I'm Richard Dennis, and I'll be back with the last edition of The Lucky Country for this series next week. Thanks for listening.